Henry David Thoreau was one of America's most unusual writers. He built a little one-room cabin out on Walden Pond near Concord, Massachusetts. Lived there a couple of years alone, but ran afoul of tax authorities. There was a certain taxation he was to pay, which he did not pay, and so he was cast into jail. A man who had befriended him when Thoreau's father was a pencil salesman and his mother took in boarders, a man who had made him his gardener and handyman and taught him a good many things, Ralph Waldo Emerson, came to visit Thoreau when he was in prison. He looked through the jail bars and said, "Henry, what are you doing in there?" Thoreau looked out and said, "Nay, Ralph, the question is, what are you doing out there?" He felt that someone else should have been following his own resistance to civil authority, not just himself. But out of that kind of thinking, Thoreau once said, "If a man fails to keep pace with his companions, it may be because he is listening to the music of a different drummer. Let him step to the music he hears, however far away or measured." Here is a person who sees that there are times when a person has to walk out of step with his fellows because he listens to the sound of a different drummer. The drummer may be even farther away than the near noises. I suppose the common complaint of our time about God is that if he's there, he's too far away. The drummer is so distant, we aren't sure we hear the beat of his drum. The mood of our time is to question whether or not there is a God. Recently, Samuel Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot, had a rather wide playing and reading. It pictures two characters standing on a stage all through, Vladimir and Estragon, and they engage in empty, senseless conversation, which leads to nothing at all, because both of them are waiting for Godot, but Godot never appears. Their whole life, their purposes, their values all depend on Godot's appearance, and he never comes. The play is commonly interpreted as meaning that God never comes, that Godot is a cipher for God, and this is a picture of modern humanity standing and waiting for God who never really comes on stage. Our generation seems to have decided, at least in many of its parts, that God is a useless hypothesis. We can get along quite as well without him as with him. It's difficult to be assured of him, and it's just as easy to go on managing our affairs without him. After all, with our creativity, with our technology, we're able to handle most situations without a great deal of concern. And yet, there are values that we cannot establish by ourselves and that all of us expect other people to live by. We may even expect ourselves to live by them. We're expected to be honest, not to lie, not to beat our wives, to rear our children. There are certain things one is expected to do because there's a value-making power somewhere beyond oneself. It isn't so easy to dispense with God or the thought of him and have life go on as we think it ought to go on. If one were to read the case books of psychiatrists and psychoanalysts, I think he would be surprised to note that there's rarely a case of people in mental distress in which religious questions do not play some role. We are concerned, although the surface may be unruffled. Just below the surface, there's the clenched fist, the red eye, the anger ready to burst, because modern man is not as soothed as he seems to be. He's not as sure of himself as he'd like others to think he is. We do miss the presence of God in our lives. A few years ago, Henry Sloan Coffin was preaching a sermon in New York on the text, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." He said if this text had been written in this time and in this place, it would have said, "Thou shalt have at least one God." I think Coffin was pretty accurately laying his finger on the problem of our time. In ancient times, the problem was having too many gods. In our time, it is of not having God at all. There is a need for one to listen for the drumming of God himself, to know something of God's presence in life. And the question of God's being there and his laying demands on our lives is what I wanted to look at with you this morning. How do you prove the existence of God to somebody who doesn't believe it? How do you go about showing that God is and that he has a right to lay demands on our lives? Well, if you want to prove the flag is red, white, and blue, you just look at it. If you want to prove salt is salt, you just taste it. If you want to prove a proposition in math or geometry, You simply make sure that the proposition to be proved is consistent with the axioms that apply in that particular field. But how do you prove the existence of God? We've come to the place that we think nothing is proved, nothing is at all certain unless we can experience it empirically. And if we're looking to taste or touch or hear the sound of God's voice or see Him physically, then we're in for a disappointment. We're not going to have that kind of proof. But if we're willing for the proof to be consistent with the area in which the proof is to be accepted, we wouldn't expect to see God through a large telescope or to be able to weigh Him as we would a bag of potatoes. We would expect some different criteria to apply here. For centuries now, men have been wrestling with the question, and they've come with three or four major arguments for the existence of God that I think are worth rehearsal and understanding. One of them is the ontological argument. It's probably the most difficult of the group. It's derived from a Greek word meaning being plus a Greek word meaning reason, to reason about being. And we all reason about being once in a while. Who am I? Why am I here? Am I dependent on anyone else? This argument was stated by a man named Anselm, who died in 1109. He was Archbishop of Canterbury when he died. Anselm said, "I have an idea in my mind of a being than whom no greater being can be imagined. But if this being doesn't exist, if he's only an idea in my mind, any being that exists is greater than he is, because a being that exists is greater than one that exists only in somebody's imagination. Therefore, God exists." Doesn't move a lot of people. It looks like he's only shown that he has an idea in his mind. He hasn't shown there's a reality on the outside of his mind that corresponds to it. But Anselm had a framework within which he argued. He'd observed that in his world there are certain contingent things. They might be this way, they might be another way. There are certain necessary things. They have to be this way. Most of the barns in Sweden are painted red. That's because the soft red rock and the Swedish soil makes it easy to make red paint. Might have been some other way. That's a contingent thing. 10 plus 10 equal 20. That's necessary. Just has to be that way. Anselm's point was that he had an idea in his mind, the origin of which he couldn't explain, of a being who was greater than any possible being beside himself. Now, that kind of greatness involves existence. Descartes, who's called the father of modern philosophy, took up the argument and attempted to refine it a bit. He said, "I am a finite, imperfect being. Yet I have in my mind an idea of an infinite, perfect being." Where did I get that idea? Being such as myself could not have originated it. It must have been put there by the infinite, perfect being. Well, it may still seem to you that the thought that you're a creature over against one who created you is something a bit intangible. But the ontological argument has shown a real propensity for staying around. It's been here not only the 1,000 years approximately since Anselm's time, it's been here thousands of years. And almost every decade there's a new book which summarizes the most recent discussion of the ontological proof for the existence of God. It's not so easy to do away with because you do have a kind of creaturely feeling that's innate to yourself. A second argument is the cosmological argument. Cosmos is the term for world, and logos again, to reason about the world. This argument usually stated in a cause and effect form. Plato and his Timaeus around 400 BC said, "In our perceived world around us, effects are always produced by causes." And he reasoned that the world itself is an effect and God himself must be the cause. Aristotle, his pupil, said, "If there is no first cause, then there's no cause at all." Aristotle noted, too, that when things happen in our world, an effect is produced by a cause. But that cause was not a first cause. It was in turn caused by something else, which was in turn caused by something else. There are lots of intermediate causes between the first cause and the cause of the effect that happens right now. But his point was, if there's no first cause, there's no cause at all. Because someone had to put it all in motion or effects wouldn't be happening. You start with something like your own soul. You didn't originate it. You didn't bring it into being, yet it is. You start from the fact that intelligent beings exist, but in the world of your observation, intelligent beings do not come from unintelligent beings. Is it intelligent to insist that they must have at some time in the past when they do not now? Or is it intelligent to reason that since intelligent beings always come from intelligent beings, an intelligent being always existed? The cause and effect argument. Or there's the argument from design, usually called the teleological argument because of the Greek word telos, which means a goal, a design, an aim, a purpose. To reason about purpose. What is our purpose? What's the design of the universe? Or who designed it? The design argument, again, has been stated in a number of ways. William Paley's statement is probably the most commonly known one. He pictured a man walking across a barren wilderness, and his foot stumbles on a watch. He never saw a watch before. He picks it up, looks at it carefully, finally takes it apart, observes all those wheels and cogs and jewels and springs and levers inside. And he notes that when he cranks this little stem, it runs. And as it runs, it seems to keep time. It's consistent with what's going on in the world around it. And he reasons, well, there must have been an explosion in a metal factory near here with all the little pieces coming together to produce this sort of thing. I never saw it before, but it works well. Or does he reason there's somewhere a watchmaker or there wouldn't be this watch? Well, that was Paley's conclusion. Emil Brunner, who is a recent Swiss writer, stated the argument in a little different way. He reasoned that the structure of an insect, the beauty of a fresh spring meadow, the retina of an eye, offers something not fully explainable in human terms. That someone, somewhere, has created this design. Because we live in an orderly universe, there must be an orderly mind behind the orderly universe. About 30 years ago, a man named A. Cressy Morrison published a little book he called Man Does Not Stand Alone. On the opening page of the real content of the book, it's page 11, but he has some prefatory matters, Morrison gives a simple little illustration. Suppose you have 10 pennies in your pocket and you number those pennies 1 through 10 consecutively. You put them in your pocket and you attempt now to draw them out in order. What are the odds that you'll draw out number 1 first time? 1 in 10? But each time you draw one out, you put that penny back. What are the odds you'll draw 1 and 2 out consecutively? 1 in 100? Putting the pennies back each time, what are the odds you'll draw out 1, 2, 3 consecutively? 1 in 1,000? 1, 2, 3, 4? 1 in 10,000? What are the odds you'll draw out 1 through 10 consecutively, putting the penny back each time after it's drawn? 1 in 10 billion? Simple little experiment. You can try it sometime when you have 2 or 3 hours. But Morrison decided, we live in a world far more complex than this. Far more complicated than 10 pennies in the pocket. Here are gases and a certain balance or I'd die. Here's a certain distance from the moon or I'd be flooded every day. Or the surface of the earth would crack through dryness. Here is an axis tilted a certain way or there wouldn't be any seasons. Where did all this design come from? If something so complex is here, shall I decide that it was produced by blind chance? Then what shall I say of origins? How did chance produce something? Where did the materials come from? Or shall I decide that there is an intelligent creator behind it all? Then there's a fourth argument, the argument from the kind of beings we are, the argument from cause and effect, the argument from design in our world, and then the argument from the moral feeling that a man has on the inside of himself. Paul said in Romans 2, verses 14 and 15, when the Gentiles do by nature the things that are written in the law, they, having not the law, become a law to themselves. And he goes on to say that they show that the law of God is written in their hearts, their conscience either accusing or excusing them. Here are pagan people. They don't have any knowledge at all of God's revealed law, and yet they have a sense of oughtness to which they respond. They're either obedient or disobedient. Wherever they are, men are like this. They're conscious of moral obligation. C.S. Lewis, I think, is the simplest writer, the clearest writer on this subject I've ever read. He pictures overhearing a couple of people in a quarrel. Everybody's had that experience. One of them says, how would you like for somebody to do that to you? That's my seat. Why did you take it? Leave him alone. He isn't bothering you. And on, the quarreling goes. But the interesting thing, Lewis says, is that both of them seem to realize that there's a standard somewhere by which their conduct is to be judged. They have to prove that it's all right to do this thing to another person, or that it's all right to take this seat, or interfere in another person's affairs. And even more strange, perhaps, is the fact that the person who has obviously done the wrong never says, well, fooey on your standards. He always says, but wait, I did the right thing, and here's why. Or he gives an excuse which he thinks is good enough for him not doing the right thing. Both parties in the quarrel seem to recognize an authority beyond themselves, a standard, or they wouldn't keep quarreling. Now, where does that standard of right and wrong come from? Can you imagine a country where people are praised when they run in battle, run away? Can you imagine a country where it's the honorable thing to double-cross all your best friends? About as easily as you can imagine a place where 2 + 2 = 5. There's just a moral standard that everyone is aware of. Now, we may get our conclusions wrong, just as we may add up our sum from a column of figures wrong, but we still recognize a standard. So Lewis says, really, there are only two ways to look at the universe, materialistically or religiously. The materialist says, it's all here, it all came by chance, I have no idea how it occurred. The religious person says, someone is behind it. It has purpose, meaning, and the person who brought it into being is conscious of having brought it into being for that purpose. It's that difference between the two ways of looking at the world that Lewis is pointing to in his moral argument for the existence of God. Cicero, a Roman philosopher writing the first century of our era, said, what the gods are, men dispute, but that the gods are, no one denies. Things have changed a bit since that time. A person may even deny that God does exist. And yet, the people who are in best position to judge, most competent to make the judgment, say that there's no place you can go in all history or geography. You can't go back in time, you can't go to any place where there was ever a tribe or a people without some sort of religious awareness. They may have had a crass conception of God. He may not have been personal, he may not even have been spiritual. But there's some kind of religious awareness and a response to it wherever one looks. What about you? Can you honestly say that there was ever a time in your life when you thought, I'm all my own. I belong entirely to myself. I'm responsible to no power beyond myself. I can never remember such a time. I was always aware that I was somehow responsible to someone beyond myself. That a greater power than my own already had a claim on my life, and that I was under responsibility to him. Unless we're mere spiritual stamp collectors looking for arguments on both sides of a religious question, it seems to me that the reasons for belief in God are absolutely compelling. But it's more than an intellectual exercise. I can think of a better argument than you can, or I can always respond to one you think of. It's a question of life and how life is going to be lived and whose drum one is going to listen to as he goes through life. Are we going to always keep pace with our fellows, the world of our time, or are we going to listen to the beat of a different drummer, however distant? Zorba the Greek has a way of putting things pretty concisely. Alexis tells the story of going to see an old man often when he was a child, and the old man would talk with him. One day he took me on his knee, placed his hand on my head as though he were giving me his blessing. Alexis, he said, I'm going to tell you a secret. You're too small to understand now, but you'll understand when you're bigger. Listen, little one. Neither the 7 stories of heaven nor the 7 stories of earth are enough to contain God. But a man's heart can contain him. So be very careful, Alexis, and may my blessing go with you, never to wound a man's heart. Though you can't, with your 5 physical senses, get hold of and contain God, the old man was saying a person's heart can contain him. So be careful how you treat another person. He may have the presence of God in his heart and life. But that presence of God begins with trust and obedience. Would you do His will while we sing?
Be seated.